Thanks to the organizers. I started this piece last year that just wrapped up the philosophical op-ed contest that they run every year. So this started as a short entry for that. And so thanks also to them for supporting this work. So this talk is Against Greatness, the Case for the Good Enough Life. I fear if I turn my head too much, I'm going to lose the mic. So I'm just going to look at you guys. I'll try to do a bit of both parts of my talk here, a little bit of what I'm against, why I'm saying I'm against greatness, and what the case for what I'm calling the good enough life is. And I'll try and explain what I mean by those things, hopefully clarify a bit as best I can in about the 20 minutes that we have. And if there's any time, I'm happy to chat about it. So look, I think we know, probably a lot of us, what the problem with greatness is. We know that we live in a society that has too much excess. There's too much inequality, there's too much ecological destruction, there's too much pressure and anxiety and burnout and alienation. There are many causes for these things, of course. One of them, I think, is a certain societal ideal of greatness. What I mean by that is a society that is designed for all of us to benefit, right, or for all of us to think that we will benefit through a relentless pursuit of being the best, and with that, having access to the best, right? So it's not just about being the best lawyer or the best doctor. It's about thinking that because I'm the best lawyer, whatever that might mean, I'm also going to have access to all these other bests in society, right? I'll have access to the best medicine and the best education for my children, the best housing and so forth. And what this tends to do is to drive as many people as who think can kind of win this contest into the pursuit of greatness. Those of us who try to opt out are promised, look, it's going to be okay because this is all going to trickle down to you. And probably most people here, right, we don't believe in trickle-down economics, but we often still subscribe to ideas like trickle-down culture or trickle-down scientific research, right? We think if there's Einsteins and we support them, we'll get the benefits from that. And if there's great culture all around us, those benefits will come down to us. And so there's maybe some logic to supporting this. And there might be some truth to this, but I think there are great collateral damages that come from designing a society in this way and that are avoidable if we rethink some of how we do that. I think my lived experience, and I assume probably for a lot of you, the profession that I'm in, I teach writing at a university, and what I've seen over the years teaching is that there are fewer and fewer stable jobs, right? And these become these kind of great commodities, these tenure-track jobs that promise you stability and research money and conference access. And the idea, again, is that if we support like the best scholars, we'll all benefit from their research. But this isn't really what we're finding. We're not finding that these people are able to do more research. We're finding they're more stressed, they're more anxious, they're more burned out because they're trying to produce so much to make it to the top. And everyone else is not winding up in some kind of middle class of the university. Everyone's getting pushed into this kind of adjunct underclass, contingent labor, feeling precarious. And this also means that jobs that don't necessarily have this aspect of the top or an ideal of the top wind up getting devalued, right? A lot of the things that make our lives possible, the logistics, the services, the things that make New York City such a wonderful place to live, those jobs in a greatness-oriented society don't get the respect and appreciation that they need. And yet they still have all the same pressures and burnout because if you try to live in New York, right, as probably most of you know here, you have to you can live without making a lot of money, but it becomes increasingly difficult as cost of living rise. And so we're all feeling these continual pressures. Let me be clear as I'm saying this, because people ask me sometimes, it doesn't mean that I'm opposed to excellence. Right? I think we should do our jobs well. I worked hard on this talk, I assume, right? We all work hard on the things that we do. But what I'm opposed to is an idea of doing things well in order that you might have access to all these other great goods, right? So that what you're not doing for its own sake, right? I don't wind up writing a talk just because I want to write a talk that's going to engage everyone, keep you awake at 1 a.m. I'm writing a great talk because I think it's going to be part of my ability to maintain myself, to maintain my living. And, you know, it's not the worst thing for a university professor, but if you think about what happens when doctors do that, right? And doctors decide they want to be rated as the top surgeon. And what happens is they wind up trying to do a lot of research. They maybe pay less attention to their patients. They maybe do more conservative surgeries as things get rated based on success rates, as opposed to the quality of total care you provide. And it does happen at universities like the one where I teach, which is primarily concerned with growing its endowment. And whether that means that at the end of the day we offer as good an education, or whether it means that we're trying to get our students out the door so that they go into finance and come back and try to grow the endowment so that our prestige grows in this kind of economy, right? Everything is getting skewed. So not only is greatness creating all these problems, but it's also perverting the very things it's meant to be enhancing, right? The pursuit of greatness is this kind of counterproductive process. And of course, right, I'm not even talking about the obvious things, right? What happens with a company like Facebook and their willingness to pursue profits, or what happens with airline industries or oil industries and so forth. And I also just want to say, there's a man named Fred Hirsch, he's an economist about 50 years ago, and Hirsch said, you know, we talk a lot about material inequalities, but we don't always talk about what he calls positional inequalities. And so what I'm talking about here with the issue with greatness is not only about the amount of wealth someone has, but also our access to these positional goods. I think this is an important issue. And positional goods mean things like leadership positions. If there's the best housing in an area, right, there's only so much of it. We can think about wealth that can be redistributed, but there is also social limits to growth, as Hirsch put it. There are things that cannot be redistributed because they're just necessarily a fixed amount of them. Top museum shows, giving the endowed lecture, whatever it might be, right? These kind of positional goods exist across all of our spheres. And what happens with positional goods is that you wind up, even if it's not an economic issue, it's an issue of access, it's an issue of feeling locked out of something. So greatness has an economic base, right? The system that we live in exacerbates this problem. But it's important to remember that even in an egalitarian society, the kind of one I'll be arguing for, positional goods remain a problem, right? Access to power remains a problem. If you think a lot of the failures of some states that have tried to make themselves more egalitarian, they have not always dealt well with positional goods issues and created new spaces, new zones of power. It's also a reason that issues like race and gender and ability remain important even in an egalitarian society, because again, you may find that everyone has the same material goods, right? But do they have the same kinds of access? Are they awarded the same kinds of respect, right? How do we think through these kind of problems if we manage to have an egalitarian society? One way that people say is, okay, well, we'll let the meritocracy decide. Like, if they're going to be goods that no matter what, not everyone can have, they're just going to go to the best of us. And, right, again, we might think this makes a kind of intuitive sense. We want there to be more Toni Morrisons and more Albert Einsteins, and we're willing to put our resources into them because there's a kind of logic here. But if you ask, right, how do we find these people? How do we ensure that the best people are getting these resources? The system becomes a bit obscure. If you think, for example, about, say, trying to find the next great physicist, there's one fellowship coming up, there's 1,000 applicants, all of them are really good, reasonably well-qualified people, one of them gets chosen. The one who gets chosen then gets all this time and all this money and all this access and all this prestige to pursue their work. And then when another fellowship comes up, right, that person's now in a position to be chosen again. And so there's this accrual of benefits that keep coming back on the same person. Whereas in fact, right, our Einstein or our Morrison or whoever it might have been in those other 999 people, right? We may have in fact lost this person in our very attempt to reward the best. So there's all these sets of destructive cycles. I think, look, it's important to be able to find these people, but we should also think about what happens when we design a society that is only geared towards finding the best and promoting the best. What happens, in the words of the novelist E.L. Doctorow, when we have a terrible depressant of human energies, right? We think we're investing all of our energies in the right places, but in fact, we're ignoring all the energies of the 7.7 billion around us and focusing on this small sliver, right? So how might we think about a society that involves those other attributes, those other elements? So this is what I'm gonna call the good enough life. I mean good enough life in the sense of a life that whose normative horizon is not to find the kind of great few and support them, whatever that might mean, right? But to find a way of organizing society, this won't sound too dissimilar from things you've probably heard, but that is concerned with creating decency, meaning, sufficiency for everyone, right? That takes as its primary goal in orientation and design. Let me also just say, just as with greatness, I want to make a clarification, so with being good enough, I think the phrase often has a kind of haphazard feel, like, that, you know, bedstand's good enough, it's okay if it's rocking a little bit, whatever. That's not what I mean by good enough, right? I really mean something that is good and something that is enough. And I mean something that is in that way for all of us as its goal. Just as greatness, I think, has these interpersonal problems and these individual problems and these political issues, I think good enoughness can respond to all of this. And I'll try to make that case somewhat briefly here, right? But I think what it does is to allow for more tranquility and creativity and adaptability for us as individuals. I think it creates more time and care and everyday pleasure for us in our social relations. And I think it creates greater political cohesion and cooperation. And it also creates eventually greater ecological sustainability. And I won't say so much about that last category, but I just mean when we stop thinking about the Earth as this great, vast, unending resource, and we understand that it too is good enough, it too has its limits, right? We start to transform our orientations. Part of my point here is some of the things I'll say may sound occasionally like schlocky self-help types of things, and there's an element of that in this, but the point is that these things are all connected, right? It's not just that individually we can try to be good enough, it's not just that in our relationships we can be, it's that we'll need to really think broadly about how these things are connected and related to the political systems that we live in. So some of you may know that the phrase good enough, at least in a lot of its modern orientation, or at least where I take it from, is a psychoanalyst named Donald Winnicott. And Winnicott was interested in infancy. And he was concerned that when we try to be great parents, right, especially as the child kind of leaves the warmth of its parents' bodies and enters into the difficulties of navigating the world, that if we try to be great, what we'll do is give the child a false expectation of the world that they're entering into. Right? The world is not perfect. It doesn't provide everything we need. It's in fact fraught and difficult. And again, even in an egalitarian society, there are tragedies, there are car accidents, there's betrayal, there's unrequited love, there are things we can't overcome. And what Winnicott said is if we treat our children as if like we can give them everything, we will not prepare them to enter this world. We'll not prepare them for a good enough existence, which is all that the world can ever offer any of us. And so he says we have to disillusion our children. We have to get them to be prepared to experience frustration and difficulty, and from this will come their creativity and their adaptability. And again, I think, you know, I looked up the other day in the satirical magazine, The Onion has a dictionary, and they define philosophy as something like the endless pursuit of wisdom over thousands of countries and centuries to realize that life is like a roller coaster and you win some, you lose some. And there's something of that here, right? There is this kind of like, look, it's only ever going to be good enough. Don't worry about it. But, and I think this is important, as much as we might realize that ourselves, we have something like what we could call the other parent problem. And in this problem, I think, okay, I'm going to raise my child to be good enough. I think this is important, and this is how I'm going to go about things. But the person down the block, they're going to be this great parent. And they're going to do everything they possibly can for their kid, and they're going to wake up at 3 a.m. and bring them to Latin class and then violin class, and they're going to speak all these languages and play all these sports. And I just want to raise a good enough kid, but look, my kid's going to feel really left out in a society where everyone else has been raised to be great. How are they going to relate to these other people? So I think there's a lot of ways of thinking about this. One of the things we can do is adjust our cultural norms, right? What are the expectations that we have for ourselves and for the kinds of images we project of our future? Obviously, one place that we get these norms are from Hollywood films, for better or worse. And a lot of what we see today in films that, you know, I have guilty pleasure to watch, right, the Avengers or Star Wars, they are all hero-centric narratives. They are all about finding the one or 10 or however many that are going to save the planet, and the rest of us can just kind of not worry about it. But there are other films, right? There's a kind of counterculture in Hollywood that I think is kind of amazing. And there are films like Up. I don't know if people have seen Up. It's really lovely. Or Bad Moms, which really should be called Good Enough Moms. Or Talladega Nights, which is probably the worst of them, but it's the one I'm going to describe just because it has a really good scene to encapsulate what I'm talking about. And in Talladega Nights, there's a character, I don't know how many of you have seen this, it's a Will Ferrell movie. There's a character named Ricky Bobby, and he's a race car driver. And when he's born, his father says to him, slightly after he's born, his father says to him, either you're first or you're last. And he lives by this mantra. He thinks his whole life, okay, I have to be the best, I have to win every race, and if I don't, I'm last, I'm nothing. And there's that whole, right, this is the greatness mentality. Either I'm number one or I'm nothing. And everything falls apart in his life. Of course, he destroys all of his relationships, his friends hate him, his wife leaves him, and so on. And eventually he confronts his father, and he says, Dad, you did this to me, right? You are the one who said to me, either you're first or you're last. And his dad looks at him and says, I was on coke at the time. Like, that's a crazy thing to say. Like, either you're first or you're last. You could be second, you could be third, you could be fourth, fifth, whatever, you know. And so, you know, this kind of moment of redemption, and he goes on and heals his relationships. And I think what's important here, right, is not only the message that the film gives, but also the fact that it happens through humor, right? I've said that Good Enough Life involves some degree of tragedy and some degree of difficulty, but it's also about this kind of joy of everyday interaction. It's about this pleasure in ordinary things that we lose when we're only trying to be the best. If you want to get away from Hollywood, I think there's a poem that really captures this by a writer named Naomi Shihab Nye. The poem's called Famous. I'll just read a few lines. I want to be famous to shuffling men who smile while crossing streets, sticky children in grocery lines, famous as the one who smiled back. And I think this is just such a beautiful image of what a good enough life looks like, right? You're in line, there's this kid in front of you, they take out this candy, they stick it to their face, it's a bit of a mess, and you just smile, right? That's it. This is our ordinary, pleasant moment. But of course, it's really nice to imagine and really hard to actually embody, because what happens in that scene in real life is there's a argument that happens between the clerk and the person in front of us about whether or not they have to pay for the candy the kid just ripped open. The clerk is underpaid and overworked and underappreciated, and she's frustrated, or he's frustrated, they're frustrated. The parent in front of us is also really annoyed because they have to get this kid to Latin even though they're only 4 years old, and you have to go give 6 lectures as an adjunct professor, otherwise, you know, you're not going to be able to pay your rent. Okay, so then no one's smiling at this kid who has the sticky thing on her face. So this can't just be something that we think about in our norms. This also has to be something that we think about in social policy. And I don't know that I have answers here. I have some ideas. I'll throw them out there. But I think some of them are relatively obvious, right? If we want to think about a world in which we have this kind of adaptability, this creativity, this pleasure in our everydayness, we do need to think very seriously about the redistribution of both material and positional goods. We need to think about how to limit the power of money, not just in politics, but in what money can buy. Right? The logic of a public healthcare system is that we are all invested in everyone having good enough care, right? If there's no great care for you to get to, then you're not trying to be the parent who does all these things or goes through all these hoops, because there's no benefit on the other side, right? By controlling the degrees of the benefits, we can start to change some of these social relationships. Another thing, you know, I don't know, maybe people here know more about this, but I remember when Amazon was coming to Queens and there was this fight against it, and there was this victory kind of against greatness, right? Amazon was not coming to Queens and the destructiveness that that might have brought. But there wasn't a good enough response, right? There wasn't something that followed after that said, hey, there's billions of dollars of subsidies on the table. We don't want them to go to a great company, so-called, like Amazon. We want them to be distributed to a worker-owned enterprise that's going to develop the community here in Queens, right? We're not going to wait for the great company or great savior, whatever, to come and save us. We're going to do this ourselves, and we're going to have something where our from our janitors to our managers, everyone's respected, everyone's an owner, everyone's part of the company, right? It's things like that, those kinds of institutions that enable these kinds of relationships, these ways of being that we want, right? Our schlocky, self-helpy, just chill out. It requires these kinds of broader sets of relationships. I think there's another idea that I like, and I don't know really how well it would work, but there's a psychologist named Barry Schwartz who's written a lot about the idea of being good enough. And Schwartz says, we need a good enough college admission lottery. And what this would mean is that, look, you've done whatever, well enough in your school. We know that when people enter into college admissions, a lot of excellent students don't get in for whatever set of reasons, whatever luck of who is reading the application that day. And we'd have to wait, right? We'd have to find ways to kind of prioritize people who, because of whatever disadvantages, didn't have the same test scores or the same capacities to do things. But we make a good enough cutoff. We say, look, if you've done a certain number of activities, if you've gotten a certain score on your exams and your grades and whatever, you're put into a lottery. And that's it. So all that time you spent trying to learn Latin and play 6 instruments and have 5 varsity letters, none of that mattered, because all you needed was one of each. And then you were put into a lottery, and then it was as lucky now as it might be otherwise. Right? And what that does is to then give you back your childhood. You don't have to spend your childhood trying to get into the best school so that you can then be the best and the best and the best. You can actually live an ordinary, decent, quality life. It also then starts to take some of the positional power away from those top institutions that become lottery-based, right? It's no longer as good to have a degree from whatever school, because we all know that everyone, lots of people were good enough to be there, and only some of people wound in. Look, I don't know if these are the best proposals. These are kind of ideas. I think they're kind of interesting. Hopefully they're good enough. But What I'm interested in, right, is this idea of good enough as a normative horizon for our social designs, right? That we think in a society, not how do we get the best and support the best forever, but how do we ensure that everyone has a decent quality of life, a meaningful life, an ordinary life. Some of you may still be a little resistant, and you might say, look, this sounds good, kumbaya, whatever, but if I need heart surgery, I want the best surgeon. I don't care about your good enough crap. And I can understand that at some level. I can understand that desire. But think about what this might actually mean, right? How often do you get to plan when you have an emergency surgery? How do you know that you're going to have access to all these best things? In fact, what you should really want is to ensure that wherever you are, or whatever situation you're in, you know that you're part of a public system that's good enough and is going to give you quality of care. And you know that's true for your friends, or your family members, or your children, or just your fellow human beings, right? That we can design a society around this purpose. So I think, is the good enough life a loss? Yeah, it's a loss of anxiety, of burnout, of stress, of pressure, of frayed social relations, of alienation, of ecological destruction. And is it a gain? Yes. It's a gain of free time, of joy, of meaningfulness, of sufficiency, of stronger bonds, maybe even the planet itself. And when you see a shuffling old man or a sticky child in a grocery line, you'll finally have the opportunity and the time to be the one that smiled back. And when we're also liberated, that will be the good enough life. Thank you.